So all of a sudden it's summer, it seems. Let's see what kind of questions there are. Quite a few, but we have time. Okay, based on the limited reading and listening I've managed to do thus far on the subject, it seems like most episodes of enlightenment resulting from the first or second resolutions took place many, many years ago. Resolutions. Do you believe that the chaotic, materialistic, and overstimulated society of today is reducing the effects of first and second resolutions in any way? Are there more recent episodes? Can't think of the right word. The only two persons I can think of are the author of Loving What Is, can't remember her name, as well as Deepama. Last but not least, have you ever met Deepama? Grazie di cuore. So now I know who is the author, I suppose. Well, I have never met Deepama. And I sort of vaguely remember the name Deepama, but I would really have to dig in my memory. Who is Deepama? She's from India, I'm pretty sure. But exactly what and where from? Can you remind me where she's from? Okay. Uh-huh. And now she is now a teacher in her own right, yeah? Deepama. She passed away in 89. She was an elderly lady. Yes. Deepama. But in which tradition and all, also you're not quite clear, are you? In the Burmese tradition maybe? Yeah. Okay. She is mentioned in the book Living Buddhist Masters, I think. Right. Okay, that Deepama. Right. So she was one of the teachers of Jack Kornfield as well. Okay, now I remember. Yeah. And what do you mean by resolutions? First and second resolutions? Oh, yeah.
Or by reasoning or discussing.
Right. And then the third way was practice. Okay. Oh, you call that resolutions?
I couldn't recall the name when I was.
It's okay. But I just want to know for the sake of, you know, that I understand the question well, because I don't think I use the word resolutions, but different ways of, or different levels of wisdom and different ways of getting enlightened also, like, Kondanya, the first disciple of, or one of the first five disciples of the Buddha, got enlightened just by listening to one sermon, and he was there. And that was indeed by his being ready for it, probably over a long time, maybe many lifetimes, and he was just ready to hear it and got enlightened. I don't know how many people have gotten enlightened by thinking and investigation. That is still, I don't know whether there's something in the Buddhist texts like that. Because very often, yeah, I think it remains at the level of thinking and investigation and kind of intellectual pursuit when one discusses the Dharma, when one investigates the Dharma. But probably, but I don't know of any sort of historical examples of people who have gotten enlightenment. Usually we use the word resolutions for, that is a Pali word adhitthana or adhishtana in Indian languages and also in Sinhalese, the resolution to make up your mind to, for instance, sit for an hour, or like the Buddha did, he's not going to move from that tree until he finds his full enlightenment. Those are kind of resolutions. I was thinking that you meant like periods and revolutions or a new era or something like that. But whether the chaotic, materialistic and overstimulated society of today is reducing the effects of this possibility of getting enlightened then by hearing and maybe. I haven't thought of it in that way, whether all the overstimulation of information that you get through the media and through the internet and all that, and your busy life also, whether that reduces, or the very materialistic attitude of people being caught in matter more or less and judging people by the amount of money that they have rather than qualities and things like that. Maybe that could be a hindrance, but on the other hand, you do find that in the United States also and other Western countries, there is quite a sincere spiritual kind of movement also, you know. People are really seeking and sometimes finding, and that there's a lot of, well, I think in California, for instance, you can find more spiritual teachers than in Asia, sometimes more easy anyway to find them. Whether the followers of those teachers are all very deeply getting into it and getting enlightened, or sometimes it is a kind of what you call spiritual materialism or shopping kind of thing for one thing after another, that also happens. I do remember when I came to LA in 87 and I met Yogavachara Rahula, who was here for many, many years, when they didn't have the heating system in here yet, they were building up this place. He went to California, I think, to meet his parents, and we happened to bump into each other in LA. And there happened to be a big, big fair on, what was it called? Body, mind, and spirit. And all the different traditions, Hindu and Buddhist mostly, but also those selling vegetarian cat food and things like that were there, you see. It was, yeah, a big, like, fair. Not necessarily a fun fair, but it had all the different schools of yoga and meditation represented. Like an American Kumbh Mela, I would say, sort of thing. Yeah. I hope this will do. So I notice in this silent retreat that people also avoid eye contact. Is this natural avoidance when people don't speak, or is it included in not speaking with your voice? Also, with monastics, is it proper or not to have eye contact always? Never. Thank you. Well, in the Goenka Tende retreats, they specifically mention not to have eye contact during the retreat with anyone. So it is also a kind of communication and maybe stimulation or a kind of non-verbal, communication between people. The rules are quite numerous and strict in the 10-day retreats with Goenka, but here not as rigid. But maybe it could be a natural kind of effect of the, let's say, the injunction of not speaking and then trying to strictly keep to it. I have had eye contact, I think, but I don't know between you how it is. But it's more or less also to see who and who is here. And then you, when we have an interview, of course, also, I think there is eye contact and eye contact. Also, there's another thing like, what do you do with your eyes when you have eye contact? Do you give a wink or something like that? You know, like, then there may be something different, yeah? So, that is not done to monastics ever. But eye contact with monastics when you're talking with an... it's no problem to just look somebody into the face. And what I have noticed in places like London, people avoid eye contact altogether. You know, when they're going in the underground, in the subway, they're all hiding behind a book or a magazine and not looking at each other at all. Once again, there comes all these funny incidents, but there was this... Bodhisattva in the Metro in Brussels kind of movie on YouTube, where somebody had taken a camera and one other person went along and all these people were so serious and sitting and not looking at each other and hiding behind their books and newspapers. And then that one person starts laughing like that, you know, and then... the other person looks rather disturbed and goes back to his book, and then he starts giggling and laughing more and more, and that other person who was disturbed earlier sort of also starts to giggle, and then one after the other. And this was a real-life situation. The whole bogey was giggling and laughing the way through the tube, and they call it Bodhisattva in the Metro. So I think it's a natural kind of thing that happened here. It's spontaneously, maybe don't live between everybody, but maybe more to keep to yourself, to your own practice, and not sort of looking out how others are doing it and things like that. It would be part of that. Unlike metta and anapanasati meditation, should we use guidance to practice sweeping the body meditation? Reason being, possibility of getting stuck at one part of the body. Or that the sweeping the body meditation should be guided. Like when you're practicing on your own, maybe you lose track where you are, or another strong feeling in another part of the body may take your attention away, and then you don't move on, or you sort of forgot where you were. That could happen if you practice it on your own. And therefore this, sweeping the body meditation is very often just a guided meditation. You could also get it online, so to speak, through my website and in the MP3 CDs that are being produced very soon, I think. Absolutely. There you can also listen to it as you go. It makes it a little bit easier when somebody else is guiding you, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, they actually hit the right spot, so to speak. You know, it could be that you are somewhere else. And but this is more or less like a training in seeing that there are sensations all over the body, or to find out there are certain parts that are not so sensitive, other parts that are more sensitive, And also that when you do focus on something that you perceive more, and when you're focusing on one part, that the others sort of recede into the background, plus the seeing of the, you know, different types of sensations, and also the maybe conditioned nature of them, and the fact that they come and go, and also that they're not really me, mine, or my own, but just a sensation, when you look at it objectively. So I think it's a good idea to have the sweeping the meditation as a guided one. But if you can guide yourself, then maybe, well, it's fine. If you've been a girl guide, or then you may be able to do it better, but I don't know. Are there girl guides in the States? No. Like scouts. Not here. Okay. Yeah, so in metta and anapanasati meditation, one can do without the guidance. But the sweeping the meditation, I think it's a good idea to do under guidance. And with this mindfulness-based stress reduction therapy of Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, you know, he also guides. There are CDs where you can find the guided sweeping of the body in that way from, well, I think it starts from the toes to the top of the head in a lying down fashion. And if you try to do that yourself, because of the nature of the mind that it goes here and there, it doesn't become so complete, I suppose. Bigger piece of paper. It's four questions. You said Bodhisattva is not the same in Theravada and Mahayana. Could you explain more? What are paramis? I think that is what is written. And why are they not in Theravada? I'll just go down the list of the questions. Is everyone working on paramis as a Bodhisattva? Is there extinction of rebirth in Mahayana? How can a stream enterer not be a bodhisattva? Oh, well, I'll try one by one. They're sort of interrelated. And by the way, paramis is written P-A-R-A-M-I with an S. It's not like Parmesan cheese or something like that. It is parami or paramita, and then the plural of it, paramis. Well, what are... to explain more about the difference in the definition of a bodhisattva in Theravada and Mahayana. In Theravada, it is seen that, you know, to be a bodhisattva is a very, very, very rare sort of occurrence, and it is actually the being who is really on his way to full enlightenment, who is considered to be the real bodhisattva, the next Buddha, so to speak. Whereas in Mahayana, anyone who is practicing the paramitas, or the, let's say, the perfections, they are called perfections, they are good qualities, and I'll enumerate them in a little while. And not only that, they also have to make a resolution that they want to one day actually become fully enlightened, but they are postponing sort of indefinitely their enlightenment until all beings can attain this enlightenment. And in the wrong translation, according to some Tibetans, that is not a correct translation, but in some of the translations you find, until the last blade of grass can be enlightened, I will not get out of samsara. That kind of a resolution, there's a resolution. You know, it's a very, very, very strong, very high one, but whether people can really keep on having that over various lifetimes. But it's at least a very good motivation, I would think, to be a good human being in this lifetime with very good qualities, such as, and then actually speaking, there are 6 paramis mentioned in Mahayana and 10 paramis mentioned in Theravada. So it's not that Theravada does not have paramis, as it is sort of suggested here, but what are paramis and why are they not in Theravada? They are in Theravada. And it is said that the Bodhisattva has actually perfected these good qualities. So what are these good qualities? Such as generosity, ethics, then what is called, not determination, but then nekkamma would be a kind of letting go, detachment as a quality. And truthfulness, loving kindness, compassion, patience, and wisdom. These are some of the paramitas that are mentioned there. A couple of others, if you have 10 paramitas, it's more or less the same, but slightly worked out into 10 in the Theravada teachings. But not everybody is supposed to, not that you cannot develop such paramitas, but it is said that the bodhisattvas especially have fulfilled the 3 levels of, to be a Sammasambuddha, the 3 levels of the paramitas, not only in thought, but also in word and in deed over many lifetimes. That then they say they have fulfilled all their perfections. And that is a base on which, not only because of that, but the enlightenment then is fuller than someone, for instance, who becomes an enlightened one after the Buddha's example as an arhat. They don't have to have fulfilled their paramitas. So they actually do have these paramitas in Theravada also, like an arhat has done paramitas, but maybe not to the level of sort of offering himself as food to the hungry tigress, for instance. You know, there is a story in the Jataka stories that there was a tigress with small cubs, and then the bodhisattva saw her and had such pity upon her that he offered himself as food for the hungry tigress. And then the tigress turned out to be Mahabrahma, the god who made an illusion that there was a tigress with hungry cubs, just to test his paramitas. Yeah. Well, so what are the paramis and why are they not in? They are in Theravada. Is everyone working on paramis as a bodhisattva? Yes, I would say so. Is the extinction of rebirth in Mahayana? Well, I would say if you wait till all beings are enlightened and even the last blade of grass, and the question is, can a blade of grass get enlightened? That's yet another question. I don't think so, but it's more of a figurative speech to say that, you know, my own enlightenment is not that important. Everyone should be free from suffering. But even then, it is said that there are bodhisattvas who are already able to get out of samsara, but they still stay within samsara. It's not that they lack, those are exceptional cases, but they don't lack the necessary conditions for getting out of samsara. They already have overcome greed, hatred, and delusion, but yet they opt for a rebirth as a bodhisattva. And that is not accepted in the Theravada teachings. They say there must be some form of delusion involved in order to be reborn. And the Mahayana say, no, you can be already an enlightened being and yet, out of compassion for the suffering of others, choose to be reborn. So that is up to the debate, among the scholars, if they like. I'm not going to really participate in that, I suppose. So, but is there extinction of rebirth in Mahayana? Now, for instance, if you look at the Diamond Sutra and you see the four stages of enlightenment also mentioned there, they even have the example of an arahat as extinction of rebirth, but with the possibility that they choose to be reborn as bodhisattva. So the idea of bodhisattva, that is especially where the term Mahayana also came from, the great vehicle, is that one thinks that it is a higher aim in life to be a bodhisattva and stay in samsara than to opt out and have extinction of one's birth. So maybe it's a good idea for Mrs. Singalanona Ginamami. She likes to be in samsara, she says. Yeah, so maybe it's good if you want to stay in samsara, then you can be a bodhisattva. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, there are bodhisattva ceremonies, like an ordination kind of ceremony in Mahayana temples, especially in the Chinese tradition, I know for sure, and also in the Vietnamese. I'm not sure how it is in the Tibetan tradition, but I know in the Chinese and Vietnamese Mahayana tradition, you have the ordination as a samanera, that is a novice, then the higher ordination as a bhikkhu, and there is the bodhisattva ordination. And I think that even lay people, I'm not 100% sure, could take the bodhisattva vow. It's a taking of a vow. And in the Chinese tradition, what you see in these monks and nuns who have their hair shaven, that after the vow there are three dots, sometimes six, nine or 12 dots on their head, is not painted, but it is burnt with a piece of incense. During the ceremony, they have a little cone of incense and they undergo kind of painful experience with that resolution, it must be really strong. And then they think this is a small thing compared to what I'm getting into. And they burn these three little holes, usually on the top of the head. If you look at Shaolin films, sometimes you might see it. And some people burn it in the side of their arm also, with holding a little cone of incense and let it burn till it's finished. And having that strong resolution that I'm not going to get out of this samsara until all suffering beings are out of it. That's so there is, it's more like it's a resolution and a kind of ceremonial way of doing it, sometimes in large numbers also, not just one person taking that vow, but 10,000 in big temples, like in Taiwan. They have temples where not 10,000, but maybe 1,000 people, let's say, do that at the same time. And whether they are then really practicing fully as bodhisattvas is yet another question. Sometimes it has become ceremonialized also, this in the tradition that, it may be a good idea for you to practice these paramitas, but whether all of them are going to do this life after life after life, or even during this lifetime keep on practicing fully, that's of course an open question. We cannot verify that, actually. I think that was... how can a stream enterer not be a bodhisattva? Well, I thought I talked about it, that a stream enterer, according to the beliefs of Theravada Buddhism, has only maximum 7 more lifetimes. Did we not talk about that? We did. And that would not be enough for the fulfillment of all these and the perfection of all these paramitas. So it's sort of, in Theravada they say, if you become a bodhisattva, become a stream enterer, you block your way to become a bodhisattva, because it's not possible because you have only seven more lifetimes and that's not enough. And so what I mentioned, I think, about that most venerable Valanguda Ananda Maitreya, that he was already beyond stream entry, and yet he declared publicly that he is a bodhisattva, he wants to follow the bodhisattva path, become a future Buddha, but not the immediately future Buddha, because he is already as a bodhisattva in a heavenly, what we believe, in a heavenly realm, Tusita heaven, waiting for human rebirth, when the conditions are right, but in a long distant future. And then when I asked, is it not a contradictory statement, he said, well, that seven more lifetimes maximum is what Theravadins believe. And that meant there is yet another possibility, I suppose. Now, what suggestions can you make regarding questions that may arise after the retreat? Are there some good Buddhist meditation discussion boards? Can we send questions directly to you or the Bhavana Society? Well, those who are interested to discuss later on through email could send me an email. And if you don't know my email address, it's rather easy, olandeananda@gmail.com with Google. And, I also have a card. If you would like to have my card, I can give it to you. There's also a website where you might find some of these talks later on. Is there any copyright on your talks, or I could put them on? Okay, so then I could actually put the good quality recordings instead of my little MP3 recorder onto the website. That is not for discussing, but for hearing the talks again. And there are oodles of Buddhist discussion groups. I'm personally not participating in them, and definitely not as a moderator or something like that, because that takes quite a lot of time. But there are numbers. I suppose if you Google it up, you will find it. Definitely, if you look for Buddhist discussion groups as a Google search, you'll get 10,959 within 0.01 second or something like that. And sometimes if you go to a website, buddhanet.net, they have what is called the World Buddhist Directory, and quite a good one. If you click on that, you get the continents, then you get, for instance, North America, click on North America, then your state, and then you get a whole list of Buddhist groups. Then there's a little search window also. If you're looking for a particular tradition, you go by that tradition, and then you get a more filtered version of that whole list. So there you might find that there are meditation groups or discussion groups or Buddhist centers, even in your own area. If you live a bit far away from here, for instance, you can have a look at it. But I don't mind getting emails from you. I cannot always guarantee that I will be replying within a day or two, but as soon as possible. So, I don't know if the Bhavana Society is willing to answer questions on the Dharma, or whether that is somebody who does that, do you know?
I think the only public email would go to the office manager, and that's not really her area.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's any other contact that we have. I'd have to ask.
Right. So. Yeah. So to start with, you can send me an email, and then for other Buddhist discussions online, you can find it through Google. Now, what is a skillful way to tell non-Buddhist friends and family about Buddhist beliefs? I usually try to avoid religious discussions entirely. Yes. Well, I would say that if there is some kind of interest amongst your friends or family, and, if they show some kind of curiosity, I think then that would be a good base and then you can slowly try to introduce what you have learned about Buddhism, maybe. But if there's no interest, and if there's like a disinterest, you know, or there's a misconception on the other side about, well, what is Buddhism? Some people might think it's a weird kind of, you know, pagan, ritualistic, whatever, and they have no idea what Buddhism is about, then, yeah, it may be very difficult to get through to such a person. But if they're slightly interested or really interested, and you notice with the first contact, yes, there is some interest, then you can try. But I would say, don't go and try to go around, you know, preaching Buddhism and gaining members of the Buddhist community or something like that. It's not done also in Buddhism. Or in your enthusiasm, try to sort of, you know, impose your discovery onto others. Just keep it a little bit, well, not secret, but to yourself. It sometimes can be counterproductive if you share it with somebody who is against this sort of thing. And then it might sort of even damage your own practice a little bit if it is like that. But nowadays, I think, I'm not sure everywhere, but in most parts of the world, it is quite acceptable. And Buddhism has a very good name. Like when I walked through Paris in 1987, or 78, I think. Yeah, in 78, I can speak French, so I can understand what the people are saying. Somebody said in French, "Is this the latest fashion or something like that?" You know, I should have said yes, but it hasn't changed for 2,500 years. But I kept quiet, and anyway, and this time when I was in Paris just very recently, I don't know whether you know, but I had to go to Geneva to give a talk for the United Nations in Geneva on the occasion of Vesak, which was last month, and then I spent a day and a half in Paris, and the reactions on the streets were really good. People trying to show me the way, and if they looked, if they saw me looking at a map, not knowing where to go, "Can I help you?" and things like that. One guy had an iPhone with a navigator, and he was telling me, because he looked it from the iPhone, "Oh, it's just the third street to the left and the first to the right." And I started walking and walking and walking. And then I thought, where's that street? It turned out he had had the iPhone upside down. Oh, yeah. Okay. So. Are there any groups within Buddhism that focus more on the practice of metta towards others and yourself? I understand that all Buddhism focuses on metta, but given that there are so many distinct groups within the larger practice, I thought there might be one specifically focused on how to demonstrate loving kindness to others and yourself. Thank you. In the different traditions, huh? I don't think there's any, like, a particular school of Buddhism. Now, if you think of schools of Buddhism, like Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. Now, Vajrayana is the diamond vehicle or the Tibetan form of Buddhism. It's part of Mahayana, but it has its special qualities, why they call it the diamond vehicle. By using certain yogic and tantric techniques which speed up the, they say, the process in the meditation. And that is very often based on compassion, you know, not so much on metta, but on karuna. Karuna is compassion for the suffering of others. Now, we sort of include it in the metta practice that, you know, you feel pity for others who are suffering, but in Mahayana practice, and especially in the Vajrayana Tibetan practice, it is a special technique of exchanging others for yourself and sort of take the suffering of others upon yourself and be compassionate in everything you do. Not that that is not done in Theravada, but Theravada sometimes is a bit more on the dry side in a way, a bit intellectual. Well, no, we are accused of being simple compared to Vajrayana. Theravada is seen as the base, and Vajrayana is seen to be for the more highly evolved beings. Sometimes you get that feeling from certain schools in Vajrayana, like Dharmadhatu, for instance. They say, oh, Theravada is just the beginning, you know, it's the base of our practice. But beyond that we have evolved, and it's to a higher sort of practice. But I'm just thinking there is one particular group in Taiwan, and they have branches in other countries too, of a Buddhist nun whose name is Chun Yen. And Chun Yen, she has started a Buddhist hospital in Hua Lian, in the eastern part of Taiwan. And she formed an organization called Tsuji Merit Organization. Merit, M-E-R-I-T. And it started very small, and it has grown sort of beyond proportions almost. Now they've got a huge hospital and medical faculty and a university and their own satellite station and branches around the world. And they do action based on compassion in disaster areas sometimes, like where there's a drought or a flood or an earthquake. They go and help. You know, when Taiwan was booming in the 80s, it came up and people were very generous. There were like 15 people typing in the donations on the computer the whole day, 24 hours. And it was like they collect a lot of money and they spend it on such, beneficial areas based on the compassion for the suffering of beings. And that is a very, in most places it is rather Chinese oriented, a little bit difficult to find English speakers, but maybe in the United States, because like I know in Taiwan and in Singapore most of them are just Chinese Mandarin speakers, but in the States they might have English speaking people. But it is very much action oriented, like on doing good for other people in bad situations and for poor people and you know, the practice of Thich Nhat Hanh, for instance, you know, the Vietnamese Buddhist master or Zen master and poet from Vietnam, based in France, but with branches around the world also. His books actually used to be published in Berkeley in the Parallax Press, a special press for Thich Nhat Hanh's books. And I think now it has been changed names or ownership or whatever. But Thich Nhat Hanh has published a lot of books, and their kind of actions are also, they are based on mindfulness and metta. I would say it's also mindfulness practice, but with a lot of metta. Yeah, I don't know of any schools which are exclusively having metta as a, you know, the practice. I see James also sort of agreeing. I don't think there are. And James should know, he's one of the board of directors here and knows a lot about it. Have you ever wondered if the Buddhist philosophy was designed as an opiate of the masses, so to speak, designed to keep people compliant, submissive, and easily overcome? Please discuss your thoughts. This is a what is it called? A reoccurring query of mine. Well, you know, when the Mao Zedong met the Dalai Lama in 1951, I think, you know, they had a discussion, and the last thing he said, religion is poison. That's what, you know, if you look at the film, I think Kundun, the film about the life of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you actually see a reenacted meeting of Mao Zedong and the Dalai Lama to discuss the 17-point plan which China had for Tibet, you know, the liberation of Tibet, as they called it. You know, according to communist teachings, I think the religions in general are seen as a kind of opium for the masses to keep them quiet. And, well, that, of course, is one particular worldview which I cannot quite agree with. And it seems that within communism, some people are more equal than others. And it hasn't really worked, although it has some lofty ideals and beautiful thoughts, but in practice it hasn't really worked. So, you wonder whether Buddhist philosophy ever was designed as an opiate of the masses, so to speak. Well, an opiate that works as an eye-opener, I suppose, rather than keeping people quiet. I think Buddhism basically, with this teaching of, for instance, you don't have to believe anything because it is written in the scriptures, you don't have to believe anything because the majority of people believe it, you don't even have to believe what I'm teaching you, as the Buddha said to the Kalamas, and he meant it to be for everyone, is a rather open religion, if you want to call it, or a way of life, or a philosophy, that gives room for critical analysis and freedom of thought, where you don't really have blind belief as the base for the religion as such. So it is very much, I think, non-opiatic kind of religion. Of course, it has made people peaceful and happy, but in a different way, not by drugging them, but rather by getting them awake. And even Buddhism and a certain form of Buddhism, Falun Gong in China nowadays, is considered to be a danger for the Communist Party, because so many people became members and they are also practicing their independent thought, and it has been banned in mainland China because that it now, not that mainland China is now against Buddhism, actually they are accommodating Buddhism, and Buddhism is growing in China also. It's now maybe about half the Chinese people consider themselves Buddhists, but still it is with a bit of state control. It is seen as if you are a Buddhist, you are supposed to be an independent thinker. Be an island to yourself, be a light to yourself, don't depend on anybody else. So I would say it's just the opposite of an opiate. So I hope that the recurring query might some sort of fizzle out with this response. During body scan or breath meditation, my eyes seem to look at the area I'm trying to be mindful of. Is this a good sign? Should I try to avoid this habit? Note, the eyes move to the area as if they were open. Uh-huh. So when you are at your right shoulder, your eyes are this way and then that way. Let's see, it is like a scanning of the body is more like a feeling or perceiving with your mind, not so much a physical looking at it, but I suppose that going to that area may have an automatic effect on your eyes too sometimes. It's not that you're really looking at that area or even not trying to visualize, well, let's see. Sometimes people visualize that area, but it's more like you take your attention to that area rather than getting a picture of that particular area in your mind. So it's not mental seeing nor physical seeing, but more a kind of steering your awareness into that particular area. So, but I think just to be aware of that fact that it happens is it's not a problem in itself. I don't think you are opening your eyes and see with the eyes open. And just about this particular topic of open eyes or closed eyes, we always say, close your eyes gently and practice with closed eyes. But there are some meditations and techniques, especially in Zen, for instance, in Zazen, where they keep the eyes half open. But then they're not facing like this, they are sitting along the wall and facing a neutral wall, sitting with the back towards the center of the wall. So keeping the eyes open doesn't lead to any distractions, but just sort of the, well, the contact with the environment, I suppose. But in this case, it's just, I think, an automatic reaction of your eyes to go into that direction. There's nothing wrong with it, I suppose. But you're not using them to see something, so maybe if you realize that no need for the eyes to go here and there, maybe just the mind. But if it happens, don't worry about it. I think it's not an issue, really. And sometimes when I meditate, I remember situations where I said or did unskillful things that either harmed myself or others. When I recall these things, I end up condemning myself and make myself feel guilty as some sort of punishment. How can I accept my past and counteract these tendencies? Long question. Thank you. Well, regret and remorse is not really considered to be what is called a skillful state of mind in Buddhism, although it's better than, you know, enjoying that you have done this and I will do it again sort of attitude. but rather, remembering something that you have done, it's basically already done and maybe you regret it. And you can make a kind of resolution that I try to avoid doing that in the future. And if there's any way of making up with that person to say sorry to that person, sometimes that really helps, then you can actually do that if they are still alive. Sometimes it happens that they have, you know, already passed away. If you have hurt your parents or somebody who has passed away, then you cannot really make up for it, except perhaps in the way that Buddhists, what do you call, transfer merits to those who have passed away. Mentally, the good things that you have done, you wish them to receive your good thoughts and wishes and that they'll be uplifted and free from suffering and attain nirvana in the end. That kind of a wish can also help, since we think in the, what is called, the transference of thoughts from person to person, like telepathy, between human beings in this world, but also it seems to work between the different levels of existence. So something positive is better than just sitting and, you know, first of all, regretting and then condemning yourself for it also is yet another sort of addition to the suffering that has already been inflicted. So maybe I would say try to transform that what is called the condemnation of oneself to trying to find ways to to not repeat that what you have done which instilled suffering, and if possible to send a letter or to phone or to meet somebody and to say sorry and forgive me for what I have done. And then very often you might find, yes, you're completely forgiven, I had already long forgotten about it, something like that could be. Three more questions and 5 more minutes. Can you talk about there not being a self? If memories and consciousness are transferred from life to life, wouldn't that be the self? Well, this question can be answered rather quickly, I suppose. What we mean by no self is the denial of an everlasting, unchanging, eternal self, not the self as we call you are responsible for your own actions, by yourself is good done, by yourself is evil done, by yourself you receive the results of your karma, or you yourself recall your previous lives. That is there, but the self is not an unchanging, everlasting, eternal sort of entity, or Atman, as it is called in the Pali, or in the Sanskrit language, or the Atman and Atta in Pali, or soul that is unchanging. In the concept of Hinduism, there is something called Atman, and that is an unchanging, everlasting, eternal soul. And that travels from life to life without changing itself. But in the Buddhist concept of rebirth, we prefer the term rebirth and not reincarnation. Reincarnation is used in a lot of literature, but the more correct term would be rebirth. It's like a re-becoming, but the person who dies here and is reborn there is not exactly the same. It's of different parents in the first place, but they inherit that stream of consciousness from their previous life and the karmic activities that go along with it, and then that is not neither exactly the same nor completely a different person. So it has what is called cause and effect, and the contents of that consciousness may be experienced in the next life, recalled in the next life. So there is a cause and effect relationship and a line of identity, but not necessarily an eternally unchanging soul or core that is within that. I'm glad you have given me something to think about. Please explain, comment on shining mind. Oh dear, I don't know whether one can really comment on it. Well, when you don't have the experience, and I'm not claiming to have the experience, although I think I may have it, then it is just a word. But shining mind would be what the Buddha calls in Pali language pabassara citta. There is such a concept or a word in Pali language which says pabassara citta. That is your real nature of your mind. The mind is shining in itself, but the negativities and the greed and hatred and jealousy and such things, what we call kileshas, are just like conditioned things that are sort of superimposed on that shining mind. So if you can clear the dross of those negativities, be free from the kileshas, then your shining mind would shine forth. So since maybe we cannot really do that, but maybe we can temporarily suspend them and sort of come back to what we say through a state of being and non-becoming, at least temporarily approximate that we experience that shining mind within oneself and then see what it is like. And it is called very peaceful, very calm and beautiful, and giving a feeling of real peace, happiness and security. So whether it is the same as nirvana, that would be question B, which is not here, so I'm not going to deal with that at the moment. I sometimes experience physical sensations while doing particular kinds of meditation. For example, sensations in the chest during metta. Am I imagining this? Thank you. Well, I would suppose that you only for yourself may be able to find that one out. I can't say whether you're imagining that, but it could be. What I imagine that could be is that with metta you might feel a certain warm sensation in your chest, for instance. You know, metta is considered to be a warm feeling. There are different kinds of physical expressions of different kinds of emotions also, you know, like when you have fear, you might feel it in your stomach area or something like that. And when there's tension, you might get a stiff neck or something like that, or have a headache. And with metta, I suppose you could have certain kind of heat radiation or warmth, a feeling of warmth. So if that is the case, I don't think it is really imagination. You have to see what comes first and what comes second. Whether if you think now I'm going to have a heat or warm generation in my chest because I'm practicing metta, then it may be conjured up by your mind. But if it is just what you call an experience of that warmth in your maybe heart area or, you know, opening your heart kind of thing, then it could be that it's a real something. And you can maybe experiment with it yourself, seeing is this real or not. Yes, I do feel it. So then it's real for yourself also. It's not really conjured up by your imagination, I suppose.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.